This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. An Iranian missile strike last night marked a response to the U.S. assassination of Iranian Major General Qasem Soleimani last week. Since the U.S. strike, thousands of soldiers from the 82nd Airborne Division out of Fort Bragg have been deployed to the Middle East. Marines from Camp Lejeune will soon be joining them. This flow of ground forces signals a shift in military strategy. WUNC's military and veteran affairs reporter Jay Price joins us now to talk a little bit more about this deployment. Hello, Jay.
Hey, Frank.
Tell us about the 82nd Airborne Division and what their role is in this mission.
Well, the 82nd Airborne can, you know, one of bits of context to remember with them is they can be delivered in a bunch of different ways and quickly, right? They can deliver a lot of soldiers with parachutes just anywhere quickly. And that's part of the reason they have the role as the nation's 911 force is the kind of cliche that is bandied around a lot about them. They have a unit that's ready to go, wheels up, as they say, within 18 hours, about 700 troops, and then the rest of the brigade that has to be on call, ready to go, about 4,000 total, can be deployed within about 96 hours total, give or take. And that's what's going on now. They've sent the ready brigade. It's called something else, but you know, kind of typically they bandy around the term ready brigade. They rotate that duty between three brigades. It's pretty stressful. You have to be close to the base and ready to go, have stuff packed. Those folks are on the way or already there to a degree. That started very early on New Year's Day. I was there when the first plane went out about 6 a.m. And it has been going on since then in dribs and drabs. And that's gotten a lot of attention because this is an unusual role. This hasn't been done in decades. They've been deployed for this kind of quick reaction role for humanitarian crises in Haiti. And for Hurricane Katrina, I did that one with them, and they were in the air so quickly, the commanding general told me that later they didn't know where they were going to land. They didn't have a plan for that. So they move quick when they move. They got the call, they're gone. And that's gotten a lot of attention.
Tell us about that. As you say, the nation's 9/11 sort of force, military force, they have been on alert and served in many natural disasters and emergencies. In this context, are they considered, what's their mission? What's their role? Is it an assault force? Do they defend? Do they react to something that's happened? How are they trained? And what would be their mission in a case like this?
Well, just basically they're trained as infantry usually is. They're trained in maneuver on the ground. They're trained in this case they train constantly to jump out of aircraft, get ready to go and carry all their stuff and get it down out of the air. One of their main roles is jumping on air bases. They practice for this quite a bit. And what they'll do is say the Air Force just bombs the base, you know, hits it pretty hard. Some of the folks will jump in, they'll drop heavy equipment in and repair any damage to the base, and then start pushing a security perimeter out and start bringing in aircraft with larger and larger numbers of paratroopers. Not jumping, just landing, and expand the perimeter even further and kind of take over that way. So they have a couple of different specialties that are a little unusual other than the 911 thing, but basically they're quick, light-moving, fast, you know, light infantry troops, and they're able to respond to these things. This time, the word I kept hearing over and over again is they're being sent as a message. This isn't enough troops to take over Iran. You know, they couldn't do it. Maybe Costa Rica, something like that. But, you know, it's a message of some type, basically.
Well, let's talk about the impact this has. You talk about having to be ready at all times, but this is the first time in a while that they've been actually sent on a military mission like this. You visited Fort Bragg this week. What do you hear from the families of those deployed?
I talked to a couple of wives of soldiers who went out. One of them hasn't heard from her soldier yet. The other one had, but was a couple of days behind on what she expected would be a second call or something. And they both had, those families had substantial numbers of kids. And the two wives were part of the formal support network. The Army has a formal support network for the families it sets up that helps with all kinds of things. But they also have informal networks of support, of course, friends, family, neighbors who are often in the same boat and may have their soldier deployed in, you know, a year or so. And they kind of trade off favors and look out for each other. These were formidable women. They're amazing. They're keeping the home front together in a way that's just startling. I mean, they have, you know, they have so much to do working with these family readiness groups and kept trying to keep their own families going smoothly. But both of them had dealt with, in one case, they dealt with six deployments. Another was on the third.
Well, tell us about some of the encounters you had and some of the people you talked with.
Also, I talked with some business owners around town and, of course, some of the leadership there at Bragg. And, you know, in some sense, this is other than the quick nature of this, this is business as normal. I mean, it's been forgotten. There's already a similar size unit in Afghanistan serving. This is they always have a brigade out, it seems like, these days, and have for the last 15 or 20 years. It's been going, you know, they'll come back, they'll rest, replenish their supplies, then they'll go out again. It's fairly routine to have a brigade out, and now they've got two out. This has happened before, but the nature of this deployment is a little unusual.
I think that's reflected in a conversation you had with one of the spouses, Jill Jaragowski. Let's listen to what she had to say about this one.
You know, I think the hardest part is just the unknown, like not having a date or a time frame to like look forward to, or just, you know, the end goal, like, okay, we're almost there, we're halfway there. Like, I have no idea. I can't, you know, the kids don't know, like, will daddy be here for my birthday? You know, I have no idea. And it's easier if we know, we can kind of prep them, like, nope, dad's not going to be here until after such and such holiday or whatnot. So just that unknown, I don't know where he's at, don't know where he's going, you know. It's just that unknown is definitely the hardest part.
It's Jill Jaragowski, the wife of one of the soldiers deployed to the Middle East this week. I'm talking to WUNC's military and veterans affairs reporter, Jay Price. And so what about when we, in a military context, how has the 82nd been used in a rapid deployment like this in other contexts?
It was used in the invasion of Panama. That was the last one. That's been several decades. It, you know, again, in Katrina, I went down with them, and they were essentially running the city in some ways, you know, after in New Orleans, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. There wasn't a lot of law and order there, except for them. But I had several residents tell me that they felt safer than they'd ever felt with the soldiers walking the street. You know, this is something they train for, but hopefully it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, well, it is new, and this is, I think, one of the questions among many that get raised as to the military and non-military options on the table, U.S. intentions. Is it a security mission to protect what's already there, or is the U.S. planning something more aggressive with these troops? This is a key question and one that's raised by this deployment. Joining us now to talk more about it is Tricia Sullivan. She's an associate professor of public policy at UNC Chapel Hill, serves on the executive board of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies. Tricia, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks.
Tell us about this this latest strike now, the Iranian missile strike on U.S. military bases. Is there anything that we can tell about their strategy or their thinking going forward? Was this a message or was this the first of many? Is there any way you can tell?
So, of course, there are many unknowns here, but I think that what is notable about these strikes is that it appears at this point, or at least the latest that I saw, that there were no casualties or no deaths from these strikes. And I think that, to me at least, this suggests that Iran is trying to both respond. They have to respond, both for domestic political reasons, but also because they believe that they have to respond to deter the U.S. from taking further action. But I think that they are also trying to de-escalate. Right? This was a strike that is not likely to require the U.S. to respond with an even bigger strike back.
Well, that's a question that I want to put to Jay Price, because, again, these questions about what are the intentions of sending these rapid deployment. We talked about the 82nd Airborne, but those are not the only troops that have been sent in from North Carolina in particular, right?
No, and there are some already there as well, kind of unrelated. You know, one thing to remember is North Carolina is home to two of the world's largest military bases, Fort Bragg and Camp Lejeune. And these host troops that are the kind that fit the kind of conflicts we've been dealing with for a couple of decades now, and insurgencies, light, quickly deployed infantry and special operations forces, the 82nd Airborne, 2nd Marine Division, Green Berets, Delta Force, Marine Special Operations, which are called the Raiders at Camp Lejeune. Special operations deployments are smaller and are done quietly, but these larger deployments are usually pretty publicized, and this one has gotten a lot of attention. But what hasn't is that the North Carolina National Guard was already over there with a similar size unit. There are about 4,200 citizen soldiers of the Army National Guard's 30th Armored Brigade Combat Team already in the region. That's a pretty storied, historic North Carolina unit. They've shipped out way back in September for a routine long-planned deployment. A lot of them are in Kuwait and some other undisclosed places, but they're in the region. You also have 82nd Airborne Paratroopers in Afghanistan, a full brigade there. And this Marine unit, it canceled a planned exercise with Moroccan forces and is now attached to a fleet in the Mediterranean. That includes infantry and an aviation squadron with Ospreys, 2,500 Marines. I haven't heard any official word they're headed for the Middle East, but this appears to be at least a move to better position them to be ready if they're needed. So we have, you know, essentially four different large North Carolina units in play, and there's no telling how many special operations units. JSOC, kind of secretive unit out of Bragg, is widely reported to be responsible for the actual strike on the Iranian general, ran that operation.
Tricia, what do you make of, again, if you talk about the, you heard Jay lay out just the forces sent from North Carolina, is there a way to detect what American strategy is? Is this an effort to defend the assets that you have there because of this provocative act? Now you need to be more defensive? Or are you getting ready for something more aggressive?
I think that it's most likely that this is about force protection, deterrence, protecting U.S. assets and interests that are in the Middle East. I of course cannot know what the plan is, but my sense is that right now the top concern is about protecting what we already have in the region.
Now, what about other options, the suite of options available to the U.S. now as these tensions mount in the Middle East? What kind of options are available?
Well, the United States, of course, continues to have the option of relying on drone strikes to take out other top leaders. There's a whole continuum of options in terms of airstrikes and targets, Iranian military targets, militia associated with Iran that could be targeted.
It's interesting to think about the Iran's options too. You know, before the break, you talked about the fact that the strike yesterday by Iran on the two U.S. military facilities. Apparently, at least from the American side, resulted in no casualties. Interestingly enough, Iran media is reporting 80 U.S. military were killed in the strikes. That's according to Iranian media reports, which may reinforce what you were saying, is that this is something very important for domestic consumption in Iran. We did something. We didn't take this laying down. But could this be a kind of an exit ramp, a way for both sides to de-escalate? There, you struck us, you claimed you killed 80, we tell our folks you didn't take any, and now we can walk away.
Oh, definitely. I think that this is very, very possibly a way for Iran to tell its domestic public that there was a response. I think Iran also wants the U.S. to withdraw from Iraq. And I think the U.S. Was on its way to doing that anyway, and so Iran potentially can claim to its domestic audience that the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, whenever that comes, is part of what Iran was able to accomplish.
Now, the real question is, because of the amount of violence and the way in which tension has been raised, is it almost too late? What about public opinion in Iran? That's one question. And then there are militias controlled by various forces and various interests within Iran. that, you know, may be headed off in their own directions. To what extent are they now going to pursue their own goals apart from whatever the Iranian government wants?
So are you talking about the Iranian-backed militias
yes.
that are in Iraq now?
In Iraq, yes.
Okay. So I think that is one of the greatest threats to our troops that are in Iraq right now. And, you know, it's been reported that the U.S. has ended its training mission or has suspended its training mission. The U.S. is there with forces from other countries trying to train Iraqi forces to take over the security of Iraq. And because of this threat from the militias and the possibility also of an insider attack, some response that someone that has, you know, has access to U.S. troops could potentially take, I think that has caused this suspension in this training mission and the focus on force protection.
Yeah, Jay Price, I wonder from a strategic, but more particularly a tactical point of view for the 82nd Airborne and the other troops that have been sent in, you're in a situation where the good guys and bad guys are all now mingled together, unlike an assault where, you know, sort of in the assault on Iraq, we knew who the opposing forces were. But in this case, Iraqi public opinion has now turned, is not in favor of the U.S., the Iranian support. It's very difficult, I would imagine, to defend yourself in an environment like that, where you're not quite sure, given how public opinion has turned, who's with you and who's not.
It might not be significantly different from the peak years of the war, you know, when you had the Shia uprising, you know, basically out of Sadr City. Big chunk of Baghdad was just, you know, wasn't quite a no-go, but it was super dangerous. And militia units and just, you know, kind of paramilitary types would spread from there and do what's entirely possible here. On the other hand, you know, it sounds like a lot of the troops are going to Kuwait. They're not actually in Iraq and may not go into Iraq. So, you know, if anything, they might, I won't say they'll become targets, but they must be kind of juicy looking targets for the Iranian forces now.
Well, it does remind me, and if you remember, President Reagan, right, decided to intervene in the Lebanese Civil War and sent Marines to essentially occupy the airport. 256 were killed in a suicide bomb attack. Prompting critics to say that the Marines are not an occupation force. They're an assault force. If you want to defend yourself as a Marine, you stay at Camp Pendleton. But the president had to make a statement. So you have this conflict always of civilian leaders who need to make political statements and military leaders who understand strategically and tactically that you may well be on the wrong path, but you have to follow orders.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the 82nd and whoever else we have there are doing a much better job of security around where they're at. They have a lot of standoff. They have these kind of methods they've developed in part because of what happened there with Beirut. But, you know, in theory, the aircraft going in, ships, this is, might be one of the Marines are in the Mediterranean as opposed to somewhere closer. You know, these things are inarguably targets to some degree, but, you know, hopefully this isn't an issue and that they've got that security improved substantially so we don't have incidents like that.
Jay Price, WNC's a reporter for WNC's American Homefront Project. Jay, thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Tricia Sullivan, Associate Professor of Public Policy at UNC Chapel Hill, serves on the Executive Board of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies. Tricia, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, on Saturday, Donald Trump threatened in a tweet to destroy Iranian cultural sites. That act would be considered by most a war crime in violation of the Hague Convention. Department of Defense officials indicated the next morning that they would not carry out the threat immediately after the president doubled down on his promise to indeed target protected locations. Joining us to talk about the threat and the significance of these sites is Omid Safi, a professor of Islamic studies at Duke University. Omid, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be back.
Tell us about some of these sites that the president was talking about, these locations. Where are they? And talk a little bit about their significance.
You know, there are a few places around the world which can legitimately claim to be cradles of human civilization. And the stretch of land that goes from Iran through Mesopotamia to Palestine, Israel, is really so much of what we know of as human civilization has begun. So the fact that these are recognized UNESCO World Heritage Site really means that these cultural, religious, architectural sites don't just belong to the Iranian people. They're really the treasures of humanity. And I think what's important about them is that among them, there are some sites which are Christian sites, such as the Armenian monasteries, which go back to around the 7th century. There are many of them which are Zoroastrian sites, going back to the great heyday of the Persian Empire, when Persia was led by great kings like Cyrus, who is, of course, celebrated in the Bible as a Messiah, as an anointed one who delivers Jews from bondage. And so many of the sites in Pasargad, in the well-known Persepolis, are Zoroastrian, and the majority of them are the jewels and the gems of Islamic architecture. So these are some of the great tombs of the poets and the saints that have formed the backbone of the Iranian identity over the last 1,400 years.
You know, what does it sound like to you? It was striking to me to hear an American president talk about striking cultural sites. Well, I've heard many American presidents, in fact, probably each of them at one time or another in my lifetime, threaten military targets and sound very, very threatening about what the United States would do to another country. This is the first time I've heard a president talk about striking a cultural location. I wonder what that sounded like to your ears.
You know, I'm an Iranian American. I was born in this country. I'm an American citizen. I'm very proud of the promise that this country holds. And I'm also an Iranian, and I'm very proud of my heritage there. When I hear a sitting American president threaten the genocide of a culture, and let's not mince words about what we're talking about here. This is cultural genocide. Acts which are specifically prohibited under the Hague Convention of 1907 and the Geneva Convention of 1954, I ask myself this question: who else is threatening such action? Who else has committed such action? We have to look at groups like ISIS with their destruction of cultural sites in Iraq and Syria, and the Taliban and the famous destruction of the Bamiyan Buddhist statue. So what the president threatened to do is to put the United States of America in the same company as the actions of ISIS and Taliban. Putting aside even for one moment my own passion and concern and love for these Iranian sites, as an American, I want us to be asking the question, what have we become?
Is it cultural genocide, though, destroying these sites? I mean, you can't wipe out a culture by blowing up a building, can you?
But these are not brick and mortar, Frank. These are the repositories of culture, of poetry, of song, of dance, of music. In this part of the world, empires come and go. But culture has proven to be persistent, and people attach themselves to this memory of greatness. You are the fulfilled dreams of your ancestors. You are your ancestors' wildest dreams, as we're often told.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, as you talk about that, the idea of what it means to be Iranian is in many ways different than what it means to be American as a country born in the nationalist age, in the modern age. Very different to think about yourself rooted in a culture that has had many national identities.
That's right. And, you know, Iranians, with some legitimacy, see themselves as heirs to one of the great civilizations of the world. And, you know, the sites that we're talking about, Persepolis and Pasargad, and the great, beautiful sites of Isfahan, my own ancestral homeland, these come from the time periods where the Persian Empire and the Greek empires were the two superpowers of the world. And Iranians have a continued memory of these accomplishments and this greatness. There is no break This is a continuous living civilization. That's why it's so personal. That's why it's so intimate to so many of us.
Well, tell us more about that intimacy and your connection with Iran. As you say, you were raised there. You still have connections. Have you been in touch with your family in Iran?
I've been checking in as late as last night and this morning, checking in on my grandmother who lives in Iran, on cousins and aunts who live there. I have hundreds of family members in Iran, and we're deeply concerned about their safety, their well-being, but this also hits close to home. I'm an Iranian-American, I've got kids in this part of the world, and I had to sit down with my daughter, who is a preteen, and she wanted to know, here in North Carolina, if she is safe because she's Iranian.
Well, we heard reports about other American citizens being held up at the border of Iranian descent.
Held up at the borders, dozens of American citizens, and I want to underscore this, American citizens who are being held up, and these are not isolated situations. NYPD, the New York Police Department, the LAPD, and the police forces of many large metropolitan American centers sent out memos talking about how they're doing extra surveillance on American citizens of Iranian background. And if you know our history, you know the treacherous path that we have gone down before. When we start to look at our own citizens as being the enemy within, we know where that leads us in terms of Japanese Americans. I think that's a time that if we actually really care about the unfulfilled promise of democracy, this is a time more than ever to be vigilant and concerned.
I want to make a turn in the conversation here, and I'll make a connection, because nothing would justify the illegal harassment of an American citizen. So I'm not making a connection here, but a turn in the conversation, because I think Americans are curious when they saw the outpouring of love and affection for General Soleimani, having been characterized as he was to Americans as the ruthless killer that we've seen him characterized as. What is the feeling for Sula? How is he understood there, given some of what we know about him?
So in the last 2 decades or so, we have seen the Middle East develop to a place where there are these proxy wars and there's regional competition over who has authority. There is Iran's attempt to exert its influence, and there's the United States along with its allies in Israel and Saudi Arabia. Qasem Soleimani was Iran's foremost military strategic expert. And there are times and places like Iraq where he was unquestionably a hero.
The Iran-Iraq War.
In the Iran-Iraq War. And even more recently, Soleimani was a key person for defeating ISIS. It was ironic to hear the president talk today about the menace of ISIS and never pausing to mention that without Soleimani, ISIS would still be reigning supreme in Iraq. It was Soleimani who led the Iranian forces. So I think Iranians who defend Soleimani have every right to point to his actions in Iraq as having been responsible for defeating ISIS. On the other hand, when you look at a place like Syria, there's no question that Iran has blood on its hand. The innocent Syrian people have been caught between two genocidal forces, Bashar al-Assad, was propped up by Russia, President Trump's BFF, and the Iranian forces. And on the other side, there's ISIS, backed up ideologically by Saudi Arabia, also the United States BFF. In Syria, Soleimani clearly has blood on his hand, and he's been responsible for the suffering of Syrian people. So he's a complicated person in a complicated region, but we ourselves as the United States are every bit as complicit. And if we're going to start going down the list of people who have blood on their hands, we're going to have a long list of American politicians with names like Cheney and Bush and even Obama on that list.
Fascinating, though, that Cheney and Bush, who knew about Soleimani, chose not to take the option that Donald Trump did.
That's right.
But where do you think this is going to end? We heard talk today about perhaps an exit ramp, that both sides are looking for some way to de-escalate. Which way do you think this is headed?
You know, we are all in this together. I think whether we're talking about environmentalism or we're trying to have a life that is characterized by peace and justice and dignity, the era in which one nation can do it alone is long gone. We need one another. We need international cooperation. Unfortunately, President Trump has done everything in his power to break down our international alliances. And the very NATO And European powers that he's now calling upon are the very people that he has spent 3 years alienating, instead turning to dictators in many different countries for his support. The best assurance that we have that Iran does not develop nuclear weaponry, the same technology, by the way, that the United States, Israel, Pakistan, and India already have, none of them peaceful countries, is to actually bring Iran to the same table of negotiations. We had an international agreement that guaranteed that Iran was not going to develop nuclear weapons, and President Trump unilaterally withdrew from that. The Iranians were there. The Europeans were there. They're still there. So really, in many ways, it's up to us in this country to put pressure on our politicians to rejoin the international community that we have spent 3 years alienating.
Omid Safi, professor of Islamic studies at Duke University. Omid, as always, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.